I have the pleasure of introducing Shirley Paxman. This is a woman who grew up in a family of nine girls, and she says they're all feminist and very verbal. She has been married to Monroe on the front row here for 67 years and says that it was the best 50 years of her life. They have seven children, five girls and two boys. She has written seven books on family activities and has a bachelor's degree in nursing and a master's degree in family relations. She has three generations in her family who have worked in Africa, both women and men. Men who have done the Peace Corps and women who have gone there to work. I had the opportunity this summer of going to Africa on a humanitarian mission with my son to Kenya. And so I already have a love for Africa and for humanitarian work, and was actually very excited when I was asked to host this session because I'm excited to hear about other things that are happening there in Africa. So we'll turn the time over to Shirley. One more quick note. If you have a cell phone, would you please make sure you turned off or any other noisemakers?
Thank you for that introduction, and thank you for coming. I look at this audience and I think, except for my nine sisters, there's nobody here. That's loyalty for you, isn't it? this morning I went to a session on how you addressed sensible audiences, and they said, first of all, you need to learn how to handle the microphone, so I assume you can hear me, right? I think with this group, you could hear me without the microphone. The other thing was, don't read your speeches. Well, I'm going to have to read some of mine because of the way it's put together and the subject matter. So I'll be reading. I said, I've worried all week about this because who at 90 would take on an assignment at Sunstone? But Ike told me that gives me carte blanche. If I can't do it, forget it. And you'll all understand that at 90 I have memory losses and other things. Now, my story in Africa really begins with two books, and I'm going to start out with one of them. It's a book called Trader Horn. It was written in the about 1927 to 1929. It's the true story of a man from England. His name was Albert Aloysius Horn. He went to Africa as a trader, working. He can't remember if he's between 16 or 18, but he went to Africa as a trader, and he worked in the business of collecting ivory and gold, and he was there for 40 years. He became acquainted with all of the African tribes throughout Africa within many hundreds of miles, and he always treated them well, and they treated him well. They became very good friends. So he's walking down the street in South Africa one day, and he's nearly 70, and he's talking to a woman. He's selling utensils, and he's telling this woman about his adventures in Africa, and she said, "Have you ever written that story?" And he said, "No." And she said, "Well, he should." She turns out to be an editor and a writer in South Africa with an English background. Her name was Ethelfrida Lewis. And she said, "Write this story down for me and bring it each week to him." And so every week he would come with a few pages that he'd written about his story. Well, it's a wonderful, wonderful book, and became a bestseller, of course. And he tells the story of working with the African people. And one of the people that he gets acquainted with in Africa is what they call the White Goddess. She's a white woman who was reared by the black tribes, Isigora tribe, and She was the daughter of some English missionaries who died in Africa. I think the mother was murdered. But they left this small baby in Africa, and the tribe adopted her. And as she grew to womanhood, they called her their goddess, and she was really head of the tribe. So while Mr. Horn is doing his work in Africa, he meets this tribe. He becomes good friends with this goddess, this white goddess, and she wants out of Africa, and he said, "I'll help you." So part of the story is the manipulations and what he did in order to get her away from the tribe long enough to get her on. They were on the Congo River, and the boats were coming back and forth all the time. He was able to get her on a boat, and at the coast met a boat from England, and she returned. Well, the book became an international bestseller, and so MGM buys the movie rights to it early on, and one of the problems is, how do we finance it, and how do we cast it? Well, the role of Traitorhorn, they didn't have any trouble with. They hired Harry Carey, who was a very famous movie actor in that time, and he's to play Traitorhorn. Traitorhorn has a friend, a compatriot in Africa, working with him, a Brazilian young man that they called Peru, a very handsome South American man. And much of the story talks about him. But they get Duncan Ronaldo, who is a well-known movie star, a very beautiful, handsome young man, to play the role of Peru. Now, what are they going to do for this white goddess? Where are they going to get a movie actress to do this? Well, I'm going to backtrack a few years. Our cousin, Connie Woodruff, her mother was Josephine. Woodruff was my mother's sister. Some of my sisters will remember Aunt Josie. They had their daughter was Constance Woodruff, and her father was Lloyd Woodruff, who was the grandson of Wilford Woodruff, and he was a doctor, Dr. Lloyd Woodruff, and he practiced medicine in Pasadena, California. And one day, Connie and her friends were down on the beach and playing around. She was 17 years old. And a man in a beautifully tailored suit, very dignified man, came up to her and said, "Have you ever had a movie screen?" And she started to laugh. She says, "No, I've never had a movie screen." He said, "Well, if you decide you want to, here's my card. And you contact me, and I'll see that you have a movie screen." So she took it home, and Aunt Josie and Uncle Lloyd kind of laughed, and then they talked about it a bit. And then after, they said, "Well, why not? What do we got to lose? Go take your movie screen." So she went to the MGM studios and went through a movie screen, and her partner in the movie screen was Clark Gable. You all know him, his name. Anyway, she didn't ever give it many thoughts, and then MGM decided they're going to film Traitorhorn, and they put out a call for a screening for a young blonde woman. And so Connie decided she'd go try out. Why not? So there's a group of they interviewed about 200 young blonde women. And I'm going to have Pax tell me the time, because I could hold on this story for the whole 2 hours and we would never get to the rest of the story. So Connie decides to go and take this movie screen. And so there's a photograph of some of the young women right here in front, waiting in line for that movie screen. And she's number one in the line next to the camera. And she waits all day. And finally, the director of the movie is William Van Dyke, very famous movie director. And at the end of the day, they haven't had any screen, and Connie said she was quite a wreck. The other women just all quietly went out and went their way. Connie went up to her and she expressed her anger and disappointment. She said, "I wasted a full day's work. I would have made $7.50 today, and you have kept me here all day, and you didn't even take a screen." Van Dyke said, "You are exactly the person we're looking for. We've been trying to find a young black woman with spirit and with the personality. You're it." So she got the title role in Trader Horn. And that became the first. And so what do you do? This is a film in Africa. And MGM had, and no Hollywood studios had ever done an on-location movie. Everything was done on sets in the studio. They decide they'll go to Africa and film this. Well, so they get 5 to 8 tons of equipment. They have to take over 1,000 people. They decide to go to Africa. Aunt Josephine's worried about this. Who's going to take care of Connie? Here's a 19-year-old girl who's going to Africa alone. Keep in mind that at that time, Africa hadn't even been completely charted. I mean, there were parts of Africa no one even knew about. We're talking early in the 1930s. So she's very concerned about it and worrying about it. And finally she says to herself, "Why are you so distraught about this?" She said, "I was only 2 years older when I was sent on a mission to London." She was the first woman called by the LDS Church to go on a foreign mission. And she and her roommate, Clara Holbrook, were the first two women to go overseas. They went overseas and a wonderful mission in those days. They traveled around a lot because she went to Paris, she went to Germany, they went to Denmark. Missionaries weren't restricted by the rules they have today, evidently, because when she was in Germany, the man that met the train to take these two young Mormon missionaries off the train happened to be Elder Lloyd Woodruff. And that's where she met him, and eventually they married. Well, so they're going to Africa, and this entails tremendous days of work because everyone has to have dozens of shots. They have to get passports, visas. So they're very busy working, and they finally sail from New York to Paris, and then they have to go on the boat. Everything, no airplane travel, they all went by boat. So it took them about 40 days to get to outside of to Africa. And there's, I've got a map down here, but this movie, these people traveled 4,000 miles in Africa before they finished the filming. Now, you, just to visualize how far that is. Up and down the Congo River, the Niger River, many other places, but they take over 1,000 people with every kind of equipment. Now, they film it. Oh, and Aunt Josie said, "What's going to happen to Connie? She's the only woman in all that big thing." So the movie, MGM got her a companion, an English woman, to be her companion, to be her dresser and take care of the wardrobe and do all those things. And her English companion, she never saw her. She sacked up with one of the workers, one of the photography men, and Connie never saw her again. But anyway, they started filming, and they were about a third of the way through when sound movies came into business. They had to stop filming. They had to get all the sound equipment to Africa. The people in the movie had to learn their lines. Sound movies, they didn't have to know what, they just had to act like they were talking intelligently. Anyway, they had to learn their scripts. So it takes about 2 years to finish, and it's filmed. And it becomes, of course, one of the most famous movies made. And it became extremely popular all over the world, Trader Horn. And she had incredible experiences there. And she's very blonde, with long blonde hair. And I didn't bring you, knowing sunscreen and its restrictions, I didn't bring you many pictures of her in her costume. But her entire costume fit in a Kleenex box. Made of a monkey skin. So she's out in the sun for hours and hours and hours. And she gets ill. And when she comes home from this experience, she's almost a chronic invalid. and had to have all kinds of medical care. Now, Uncle Lloyd, being a doctor, became very interested in tropical diseases. So he studies them carefully. He takes her to New York. You can't find any doctors that know how to handle what her affliction is, African sleeping sickness. Anyway, so they tell him finally, if you take her to London or to Germany, they have doctors who know these things because they have colonies in Africa and they work with this. So he took her to London. No help there. They said the best doctors you'll find are in Germany, so he takes her to Germany. Now they're on the train traveling from where they arrived in Germany, Hamburg or wherever, and they're on their way to Berlin. Connie's in the sleeping compartment because she's ill. And Uncle Lloyd, to save money, we all have a tendency to do that, to save money, was riding in the coach car at the back in a chair and just dozing there. When he woke up in the morning, he found his car had been disconnected and had gone a completely different direction from where Connie's car was. Well, he panics. What do you do? He got off. He said, one thing I've learned is you go to the top. He said, the trainman couldn't help me. The conductors couldn't help me. Nobody could help me. So he called Adolf Hitler. And he speaks perfect German because Uncle Lloyd had served a mission in Germany. So this American calling Adolf Hitler with perfect German is put straight through to Adolf Hitler. And Adolf Hitler answered the phone. They put him straight and he said, I've seen the movie Traitorhorn. I know what it is. I know the word, part of my story I've forgotten to tell you. I know the movie actress. Her name was Edwina Booth in the movies. Now, her real name is Constance Woodruff, but when she started doing film things, she had to have a name that would look good on a marquee, and she said, Constance Woodruff is never going to look good on a marquee. She chose the name Edwin Booth, which was our family name. Her mother was a Booth. My mother's a Booth. She adored our Uncle Ted, whose name Edwin Booth, and she took the name Edwina Booth. This wasn't a bad idea because the most famous Shakespearean actor in those days was Edwin Booth on the English stage. So people connected her with him. And I happened to get a genealogy chart not very long ago that said actually she was related to Edwin Booth. So it wasn't a dishonest thing. But anyway, Hitler said, I've seen the movie and I know who she is and don't give it a thought. I'll have my SS man find her car, they'll hold it, and this is where, and we'll tell you where to go, and you'll meet her there. So he did. So he finally found Connie waiting in an ambulance with all of Hitler's SS men standing around to make sure nothing happened to her. Well, that's part of that story. Now, I think maybe I'll move on to something else, and I need to watch the time, don't I? And I haven't even looked at my notes yet. Forgive me. Well, that was our first experience in Africa in those early days, and since then we have done many, many things. I'm going to tell you quickly about the work that our son John has done in Africa. Now, this isn't a member of the family, a woman, but a man. Our son John, who graduated from BYU and went to Cambridge, England to do postgraduate work and got his law degree from the University of Virginia. And while he was in Cambridge, he started working for an international organization called the Pathfinder Foundation. Now I'm just going to read you a little bit about what John said about this. He said, I worked for two foundations for over a 20-year period from 1980 through the 1990s. Both of these foundations specialized in health care, principally reproductive care. And so he started working for the Pathfinder Foundation, which is family planning. Now, you have to understand that Africa has the highest birth rate in the world, of any country in the world. And illnesses and problems are just incredible there. One of the things that John found very early on was women in Africa had between 16 to 18 pregnancies in their lifetime, and most of the children didn't live beyond 2 years of age, and few of the women lived beyond 40. So how do you go into those countries and help them with their problems? So he works for Pathfinder Foundation. He said that was his entry point into the problems of national family planning. At first, this took on the aspect of worrying about the high birth rates. Now, I should explain that in Muslim countries, the use of condominium is prohibited. And a lot of African countries are primarily Muslim. So these women have never had access to anything like this. And it was discovered because the large number of children and youth in those countries didn't have a real future of good health. And so he started working with other organizations, and they started bringing condoms and family planning concepts into some of these African countries. Now, they also began to do a lot of work with education. One of the things John said that made him happiest was, he's always worried, have I done any good in the world today? And he said, this is one time I can say yes. He started a school, elementary school in Tanzania, where the children, women had not been allowed to go to school. He said they usually marry between, menarche, that's the time to start getting married in those African villages. So these African women have no education. So John took his per diem for the entire trip there and gave it to start an elementary school in Tanzania. He said, I can say today I did something good in the world. Well, he worked with Pathfinder Foundation. Many assignments for the United Nations in Africa, in at least, I've got all the countries he worked in there on the map, eight or ten African countries. And bringing in strategic family planning and a lot of primary health care. These women didn't know anything about, they had no trained midwives, they had no trained prenatal care, no postnatal care, and so they started training programs where these women could go to school or go to training sessions and learn how to deliver a baby safely and how you take care of a newborn. And all these programs were developed in Africa, in seven or eight different countries there in Africa along. Now, I'm having difficulty with my, this is one of the times you're supposed to forgive me for being 90 years old. I can't remember what I'm doing. Anyway, he said that they did all these programs, and he also worked with United Nations on a lot of programs in Egypt, in the Sudan, in Namibia, Nigeria, Zambia, Botswana, and Lesotho. Now, some of those countries nations I didn't even know existed in Africa, but he worked there for a very long time. Now, a few years later, our son David and his wife went on a humanitarian service to Kenya. They worked outside of Nairobi. And I asked David, tell me the programs that you and Catherine worked on in Kenya. And he said they made building blocks to expand the school. They installed rooftop solar collectors and batteries to provide light in a secondary school. One of the interesting things, they helped build a clinic that was run by Dr. Sven Swenson, Now Swenson is our neighbor in Provo. Those boys grew up together, and here they find that they're working in Africa. Dr. Swenson was there on a humanitarian service with taking care of illnesses and people there. That was a joyous reunion for those two young men from the Provo Fifth Ward to be together in Kenya, Africa. They taught the village health workers basic sanitation. They taught the children, you don't drink water out of the canal or out of the gutter, and some of them, of course, did and had dire results. They started to build a new village water storage tank, and David concludes by saying, "It was a great experience to all of us, opening our eyes not only to the poverty in which millions and probably billions of people live, and also into the network of interacting forces that create and perpetuate this poverty and the very difficult task in these many cultures of learning to change that network of people." I have to look at my time. Now, to move along a little more currently, I want to talk a little bit about her grandson, Christopher Bentley, who went with the Peace Corps to Africa, and I'm glad his parents are here. Christopher writes a wonderful story about what they did in Africa, and I'm going to read a little about what he told me. First of all, the amazing thing about the Peace Corps is incredible training they give these workers. They don't just go into a country in Africa and start working. They have long weeks and weeks of sessions where they learn the language. And he was assigned West Mali, and to I think the name of the village was Bambura, and he had to learn that language. He spent weeks and weeks and weeks learning Bambara. I think that's the way you say it. He learned Bambara, and then he found that there were some villages where the women don't even speak Bambara, and he had to learn Dogon. So he worked there for many hours of learning the language. Then the Peace Corps gives him incredible instruction on what the culture is, how you don't offend people, how you get your programs working without raising any ire about your interfering with their culture and their traditions and their heritage. And so he did all that, and I want to just read to what he did in the way of the building wells, getting water to those people. Some of these women would have to walk 8 kilometers every day to get water and then walk back to the village, and that's the only water they had. So Chris's assignment mostly was, let's get water to those villages. And he spent a great much of his time building wells. And he had to have training in how you build wells and where you find the water and how you bring it in and how you use it. So he spent a lot of time learning and building wells in these villages where these women had never had water, not only to drink, but not to cook with, or water to wash with, or bathe, none of that. So, he worked many hours in a they were trained in how to plant trees and nurture them, because in those villages they were cutting down all their forests to have firewood to cook on, and so the trees were disappearing. What's going to happen if there's no wood? So he worked for many, many months planting trees with the United Nations sponsorship, teaching those people how to nurture their trees and how to prevent them from dying, and regrowing their forest, which was a tremendous service there. While Chris was there, they planted over 200 trees in the villages, which now are getting mature, of course. So he did great work on in the forest and in the villages all over Mali. And the interesting thing with both all these experiences is family members learn to love these people. They become very emotionally involved with them. they love these people that they're helping and working and serving for. And they said, Chris always maintained, he learned more from them than he could ever have taught them in accepting, being non-judgmental, learning to understand other people's traditions and their ways, and accepting them as fellow human beings and partners in all of this. So Chris's experience was, I could talk a full hour on all the things he did. Learning about the culture and making friends, sharing traditions, and taking part in the local weddings, the funerals, the naming ceremonies, learning about Islam. You see, like I explained, these countries are primarily, they're Muslim. And then he learned how to celebrate all the holy days with his Malian family of the Muslim tradition, which is a nice cultural thing to know. He also gave some gifts. He's a great musician. He plays the guitar. He sings beautifully. And he could tell all kinds of stories and fables. And he learned theirs in return. So he felt like his experience in Africa was a two-way experience. He gave all that he could give, but he learned a great deal from those people. Now, I think I better, in the interest of time, better get on to the next part of my subject, which is the Brockbank Education Fund. Now, a few years ago, my sister Kay, our youngest sister, grew up in Provo and was working in the Grand Canyon as a waitress, and a family from New York came through, a mother and father and their two sons, and Kay's their waitress, and she waits on them for breakfast and lunch and dinner, and one of the sons is attracted to Kay. I don't know how they worked this out, but anyway, they dated a couple times, and then the New York family went on. At the end of the summer, Kate came back to the BYU, enrolling in school, and here's this young man from New York. He's gone back to New York University, gotten his tuition, come back and enrolled at BYU. So he's a BYU student, and Bob eventually, of course, joins the LDS Church. They're married in the Salt Lake Temple, and when they both graduate, they go back to New York, and they live there most of their married life. Now, when she was in New York, Kay attended Columbia University and got her master's degree in psychology and a master's degree in social work. And then that happy day came when they applied for a mission and they got a call, and their call was to South Africa. So they're off to South Africa, loving it, loving the people. The first thing Kay noticed is, there are no education opportunities for young black women in South Africa. Some of the young black men can graduate from high school, and some of them can go on to college, but no black women are going to college in South Africa. So this disturbed Kay a great deal, because as we all recognize, without an education, where's your future going to be? I keep trying to tell some of my grandchildren that, and they haven't paid much attention yet, but Kay called the eight sisters and said, can we do something about this? We said, of course we can. So she established the Brockbank, which is my maiden name, the Brockbank Education Fund for young black women in South Africa. Now, the first year, Kay and Bob put one black woman in college. And then we began to get more funds, and we were able to have 5 black women in college, and then 10, then 15. Now we've had well over 100 young black women go through college in South Africa. Now, they do remarkable things. One of our graduates graduated first in her class in college and was accepted into medical school in Durban. So last June, she graduates from medical school in South Africa and is practicing medicine there. We've had some of the young women go on to law, do postgraduate work after they graduate from college. They go on and do graduate work in law, medicine, other things. Well, there's a whole list. You'll see pictures of some of our graduates there. You'll see some of the things that they're able to do. Now, some of the restrictions are, and we have a committee there. I don't know if I have the photograph up of our committee there, but probably do. They have to be black. They have to live in the black townships. Now, you see, until apartheid, no blacks lived in the white with the white people. In Cape Town, there's Cape Town, and then next to that is the black composition, the black population, but they're totally separated from the whites. So the black townships, and so these young women that are eligible for scholarships have to come from the black townships, and they can go to any university or college in South Africa that they will be accepted into. Well, here's another. These are some of our current young black women there, but they're doing remarkable things. And we're very proud of these women and the opportunity it gives them to move ahead and away from the black culture in these communities where apartheid has been there for decades and maybe centuries, you know, see, with the separation. And now these young black women are breaking those barriers. They're highly educated women. And of course, they don't all graduate, but we have a surprising number who do go on and graduate. And those, even those that don't, we've had some that sought to get married or start a family. And even those people are better educated than they ever would have been if they hadn't had this opportunity to go to college. Now, how's my time? I've talked a long time, haven't I? I was going to explain to you, here on the table, there's a series of books that John's work in Africa has been published in. They're about five, published by United Nations and other institutions that he's written up some of his work in South Africa. I would like to mention, I think one of the books that changed my life was Aesop Dinesen's book, Out of Africa. Have you, any of you, read Out of Africa? Maybe you've seen the movie. It's an incredible film. Do you remember when that film was made? Meryl Streep played Aesop Dinesen, and Robert Redford was the role in there. Yeah, it was a great story. But when I read that book, it kind of changed my life, because Aesop Dinesen was a Danish woman, married a baron from Denmark, Borre Blixen was his name, and they moved to Africa to establish a farm, and they hired over 2,000 blacks. It was a tobacco farm, and they worked for them, and she had a different theory about blacks too. Treated them like compatriots, and they loved to come and visit her in her home, and they'd have tea together, and there was a totally different concept of black people under Aesop Dinesen. Her marriage was a disaster. It broke off right early on in the marriage, and he left. But she stayed in Africa for 17 years and ran the farm there. And her story in and out of Africa is one of the stories that and Trader Horn, there's books that people around the world read, and all of a sudden they get a different concept of what it's like being black and what it's like being black in Africa or any place else for that matter. So I highly recommend them to you. A few years ago, well, after the scholarship was started, and more young women, wonderful board of people, blacks and whites, that determine which young women are eligible for the scholarships. And it's a very rigid criteria that they go through. And so a few years ago, five of the sisters, and I think four or five of them are here right now, went to, raise your hand, all you girls sitting there, went to Africa and to meet these young black women that we have educated, and it was wonderful to meet them and to be with them and to learn how effectively this program works, because all the money goes, now I should have, all of the money goes to the institutions that they choose to go to school, None of them is paid to the individuals, but it pays their tuition, their board and room, all their book expenses, and any other expenses that have to do with their education. So they don't have access to the funds except indirectly as they use them in promoting their education, which is pretty nice. Now, I think this is rather unusual. 95% of the scholarship money raised by the family and other people who are interested and anonymous donors goes to the scholarship fund. 5% goes to the administration of those funds. Do you know what that means in today's culture when the CEOs get 45% of the billions that we just gave all those companies, you see? Why didn't that money go to the businesses? No, it goes to CEOs. Well, in this particular case, 5% goes to administration. 95% of that money stays in the scholarship fund, which is the purpose of it all. So I think I've about covered most everything I wanted to say. Probably a few things I didn't intend to say. But I appreciate you being here. Appreciate your support. Obviously, you're very supportive people if you come listen to a story like this. And if you feel inclined at any time, there's information here about the Brockbank Education Fund on the front of this table. And if you'd like to pick up any of that information, you're welcome to it. I don't know that I can answer any questions, but if you have any, I'd be glad to try. I forgot that I was speaking to a very high intelligent group of people from Sunstone, and I act like I'm speaking to elementary schools, which I often used to do, or teach. I was teaching in that. I taught a lot of nursing at UVU, and so I bring all my show and tell items. I think this is the only place in the whole Sunstone thing you're going to see show and tell. But anyway, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Yes.
I don't have a question.
Oh, Darius.
I wanted to say thank you. And I want to say thank you to the family, to your sisters.
Darius, introduce yourself so they'll know how important you are.
I'm not the quarterback.
You are in our life.
I'm Darius Drake. But I thank you and the family for your efforts. It matters. I've been to the conference. I've seen the need there firsthand. I've seen the poverty. And I've gone to those schools and I've watched parents dig foundations with shovels and nothing else, no power tools, and build those schools by hand so that their children can have an education. So I thank you for your efforts. Secondly, your grandson, is it Chris, who went to Mali?
Yes, yes.
Tell him thanks for helping my cousins.
Oh, they're his parents right there.
I've done my genealogy, and my roots go back to Mali and the Bambara.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And go home and read Out of Africa and read Trader Horn. Now there are many, many books that are being published, African stories. I can't remember the names of all. Hemingway's written, of course, about it, and lots of people are writing books about Africa. So we're learning more about it all the time. But in the 1920s and the 1930s, it was kind of an abstract country way out there.
Sure, it cried the beloved country as it did.
Of course. Yeah. And Isaac Dinesen actually has written half a dozen books, and not only did she write Out of Africa, but she's written other books too. So thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. Are there any questions? We do have a few minutes if anyone has a question or other comments. Okay. Yes.
What happened to that Gwen and Ruth?
Oh!
Good question.
Well, Edwina never did get well again and spent the rest of her life as a semi-invalid, and Aunt Josephine and her brother Booth took care of her for many, many years. The interesting thing is she lived to be 86 years old. Now, that's most unusual for someone who's a chronic invalid, but and she went on a stake mission for the LDS Church. It was kind of geared to her capabilities, but she did serve an LDS mission. And in her later years, when the LA Temple was built, she became a full-time temple worker, and she met a young man, they were in their 70s. She met this man as a temple worker. His name was Junius Feldberg, and he was a widower with two or three children, and they were married and had a very, very happy marriage those last 16 years of their lives.
Any other questions? Okay. One of my experiences when I was in Kenya was also to help with the construction of a school there, and it's amazing that the African people have hearts like you just can't believe. They're so willing to give and so willing to work just as hard as they can for their children and education. And I saw them make concrete from scratch. I've never seen that before. We just go and buy it and we mix it with water, and they did it from scratch. They got the rocks and they hit the rocks with hammers. Hamburgers probably wouldn't have worked. Into chunks of rock about that big, and then they poured the cement, and the water they had to collect was 3 kilometers away, and they had an oxen and a wagon, and they went 3 kilometers to get water and bring it back so they could build that school. And these opportunities in Africa are just amazing. So thank you so much for sharing what you have done and what the family has done.
What parts of Africa seem to suffer the most and need the most help? Africa is a very big continent.
It is, and some of the places, Kenya is improving a great deal. South Africa, it's improving a great deal. Oh.
South Africa is doing much better than most of the countries. They have a democracy, and they have votes. And Namibia, they're trying to get a vote there. Kenya voted, and there's always this altercation, where the elections. I mean, there's a thing going on in Nigeria right now, a legal thing. Was it a proper election, or did somebody skew the votes? You see, but Egypt does. Egypt, of course, because the British influence have been. They're doing better. I think those countries along the Mediterranean don't have serious problems as those down in mid-Africa. But transportation is a problem there, education is a problem, health is a vital problem. Now, one of the things I didn't mention, you probably are all aware that Bill and Melinda Gates, a great philanthropist, John came by our house a few years ago, and he said, "I'm on my way to Seattle. I'm going up to see Bill Gates and see if he wouldn't give us some money for one of our projects in Africa." And he came back and he said, Bill and Melinda Gates just gave us $19 million to carry one of our health projects on in Africa. And now, of course, they're the big thing of fighting AIDS, which is what John was doing in those early years, or in the 90s when he was there, trying to control AIDS. All the health problems were critical. But they do get financial help from philanthropists like Bill Gates, and that helps them a great deal.
Did you mention the scholarships that came in when Kay died?
Well, yes, if I can. When our youngest sister Kay died, and she was the motivation behind the scholarships, and we had about five young women in college then, and then Kay died, and in her memory, her friends from New York sent enough money to the Brockbank Education Fund that we could have 57 black women in college. And that was a great tribute to Kay because of her love for those people.